Is God laughing at you? God laughs when men fight His restraints. Can we stop the laws of nature? If you saw some men on the east side of the Cascade Mountains pushing on the mountains, and you asked them, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Well, we're trying to stop the earth from spinning." What would you do? Well, I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd laugh my head off at them. Because you can't do it. Well, how about the laws of the Spirit? Can we stop or change the laws of the Spirit? Can we stop the lawgiver? Why do we even try? Sometimes it seems like man thinks he has become so intelligent, he is finally able, he believes, to outwit God. And what does he think of our efforts? He laughs. And then when he's done, he destroys our work. Rather than fighting his controls, what should we do? Psalm 2 provides the answer. Here we are shown some people who tried to fight against the great lawgiver, and it didn't work. In verses 1 through 3, here is what King David wrote. "Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, 'Let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us.'" Well, what is it that provoked the nations here, that is the Gentiles, and the people, that is the Jews, to be violent? And why were they plotting a vain thing? What vain thing could King David possibly be speaking about? Well, the world does many vain things, as you know. But the ultimate vanity is to fight against God. He's been doing it since the time of Cain. David speaks of a time when they would be doing it, and they're still doing it today. And guess what? Every single time, it fails. God always prevails. King James I of England once said about the Puritans, "I shall make them conform themselves, or I will harry them out of this land, or do worse, or else do worse." And so what did they do? Well, they came over to this new world and helped start a great nation that ended up defeating his nation in a war. You just can't stop righteousness once it's in effect. Men will try, and sometimes it will seem like they are going to succeed, but in the end, they will fail. Verses 2 and 3 here of Psalm 2 show the vain thing that they were doing. The kings and the rulers had set themselves and taken counsel together against Yahweh and His anointed. And what was their counsel? They wanted to break the bonds of God and His anointed and cast away their cords from them. They did not want to be subject to God and to His anointed one. And in my opinion, that is still a major reason why people reject Christ today. They do not want to be restrained by Him. They don't want to be restrained morally or by any of His other laws, especially His spiritual laws. And as you know, even today, this battle still continues, even here in America. They sought to drive Him out of the school. They're seeking to drive Him out of every arena of the public, and even now, the Constitution has come under fire, as you know, for two simple words: under God. Well, these modern haters of God are also pictured perfectly in Psalm 2. And they shall progress as far as the people here in Psalm 2 did. And they didn't go very far. It is vain to be against God and against His anointed. Has anyone succeeded? No. Every single one of them has failed. The psalm continues now in verses 4 through 6 to show why it's vain to fight against God. He says here, "He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then He shall speak to them in His wrath and distress them in His deep displeasure. Yet I have set my King on my holy hill of Zion." God laughs at any such effort of man. Can you imagine God laughing? I know it's hard to picture God because we don't know exactly what He looks like, but if you can just somehow get a picture of Him and just see Him laughing. But it's a mocking laugh. And now imagine Him laughing at you. You thought you were real clever and put together some kind of plan to get rid of Him, to get Him out of your life, and there He is just laughing at you. Because He knows how silly the effort is. Well, that's what's going on here in Psalm 2. God will put those who plot against Him in derision, reversing their counsel. They sought to vex Him, but He will end up vexing them. Although they seek to destroy God, especially His anointed, He will still declare, as it is said in verse 6, "I have set my King on my holy hill of Zion." I mean, they could even try to kill Him, which is exactly what they did. But, excuse me, by that very effort, God used it to make His Son King. We know that verses 1 through 6 refer to Jesus Christ for at least a couple of reasons. The word anointed in the Hebrew Old Testament is the same word for Messiah, which in the New Testament would be translated Christ. Now, anointed or even Messiah or Christ standing alone doesn't necessarily mean the Messiah or the Christ, as we would tend to think of it. The context would have to determine. Well, what is the context here? In verse 6, the anointed is called the King. And we'll see in verses 7 and 12 that this same anointed one, this same Messiah, is called the Son of God. But also, in Acts chapter 4, the Bible shows us that Psalm 2 is fulfilled in our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And I always like it when the New Testament says how a certain Old Testament passage is to be applied. Because for us who are Christians, that settles the matter for us. But this is a prayer that the church had uttered, showing that their understanding was that it referred to Jesus. In Acts 4, starting at verse 24, it is written, "So when they heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord and said, 'Lord, You are God, who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, who by the mouth of Your servant David have said, why did the nations rage and the people plot vain things? The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against His Christ.'" Obviously quoting Psalm 2. And then they give the interpretation of it. "For truly against Your holy servant Jesus, whom You anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, were gathered together." Now verse 26, or 27, gives the interpretation for us of Psalm 2. Against Jesus did these things happen. And they said Jesus was the anointed one. Now in verse 6 when they use the word anointed, and then in verse 27 when they use the word anoint, it's again the same Greek word that is being used in the original text that is translated Christ elsewhere in the New Testament. Herod and Pontius Pilate fulfilled the kings and the rulers part. The Gentiles, namely the Romans, were the nations or the heathen. And Israel was the people. that imagined the vain things that he is speaking about or prophesying of in Psalm 2. Haven't you noticed as you have read through the Gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, how many times the Jewish leaders in particular would get themselves together and they try to come up with a question, what they thought would be a difficult question, a hard question, to trip up Jesus. And it never worked. He always ended up silencing them. It would be like an ant coming to us. Imagine some little black ants. Let's say, a couple of dozen of them. They get together and they come up to you and they say, "Hey, we got a question for you." And they present a question that to you sounds so silly and it's so ignorant. Obviously, they can't outwit you. Their intelligence doesn't come anywhere close to your intelligence. Well, even more so, can man not outwit God? It just can't be done. And yet, when these haters of God got together to try and outwit God, they actually became friends in the process. Luke 23:12 says that Herod and Pilate were not friends until they worked on this case against Jesus. Then they became friends that day. Isn't that sad? That men would become friends with each other as they joined together to fight God's anointed one? Well, clearly, Psalm 2, verses 1 through 6, is fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Let's continue to read now in verses 7 through 9 of Psalm 2. "I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance, and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. On a chosen day, he would be declared to be the Son of God. And the Son of God would rule, possess, and destroy the nations." This too was fulfilled in Jesus. Let me give you several New Testament passages to show this. Hebrews 1 makes it clear that Psalm 2:7 was spoken to Christ only, not even to an angel. And as great as angels are, they do not match the divine sonship of Jesus Christ. And so Hebrews 1:5 says, "For to which of the angels did he ever say, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you, and again I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son'?" And you keep on reading in Hebrews, and you come to the fifth chapter, the fifth verse, and it also makes the same point using the same psalm, the same verse, Psalm 2:7. There the writer said, "So also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you.'" Acts 13 tells us what days or day that Psalm 2:7 is speaking of when Jesus would be declared to be the Son of God. Here, Paul the Apostle is speaking and he says this, "And we declare to you glad tidings, that promise which was made to the fathers. God has fulfilled this for us, their children, in that he has raised up Jesus, as it is also written in the second Psalm." Now generally the Bible doesn't tell us what book and chapter to turn to, but there it does right there. "In the second Psalm, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you.'" Paul announced that it was the resurrection. That was the ultimate miracle of all the miracles Jesus performed that demonstrated that he is the Son of God. And in my opinion, the reason why that was the ultimate miracle is because it was a self-resurrection. No one stood at the tomb of Jesus and called him forth, but as he once prophesied in John 10, he would do the resurrection himself. Something that had never been done before and will never be done again. Going back to Psalm 2. Psalm 2:8 says that Jesus would possess all the nations and all the earth. One commentator said this, "In a few condensed sentences, the whole history of the world is made to pass before us." And I think he was right. Psalm 2:8 is showing us who is in control of this world. Who is in control of our nation and every other nation on this planet. And that everything fits according to his pattern. Truly, all authority has been given to Jesus in heaven and on earth when God raised Jesus from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all principality and power and might and dominion, and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in that which is to come. He put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church. Psalm 2:9 says, the Son of God would break and dash in pieces these nations with a rod of iron. If you can imagine a pot made out of clay, and you take a rod of iron to it, how long is that pot going to last? Well, any nation, regardless of its might and power, is like a potter's vessel to Jesus. Now, he doesn't even have to use a rod of iron, but it's painting for us a vivid picture. You can see him with that rod, and he hits it, and it shatters. Revelation chapter 2 is one of a couple of places in the book of Revelation that show Psalm 2 fulfilled in Jesus. That is Psalm 2:9 in particular. Isn't it amazing how many New Testament passages go back to Psalm 2 to say something about Jesus? In Revelation chapter 2, verses 26 and 27, Jesus made this promise. "And he who overcomes and keeps my works until the end, to him I will give power over the nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron." Now he's quoted from Psalm 2. "They shall be dashed to pieces like the potter's vessels, as I also have received from my Father." Now, I just love what that says. This awesome power of Jesus Christ prophesied in Psalm 2:9, he says, little old me here in Grants Pass, Oregon, I can have that power. I can share in his magnificent power over this earth and over the nations of this earth. Brethren, we need to understand who we are as the disciples of Jesus Christ. So many times, if we just would listen to ourselves, we sound so defeatist. Sometimes the devil doesn't even have to do anything because we defeat ourselves. We're too small, we don't have enough money, or this or that, and so on. And we forget who our master and teacher is. That he's the king of this world. And he shall be to the very end. Alright, let's look at the last three verses of Psalm 2. Here David again wrote, "Now therefore, be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way. When his wrath is kindled but a little, blessed are all those who put their trust in him." At the beginning of this psalm, everyone was against God and against his anointed. But the Son, he says, will destroy those people. He will destroy anyone who fights against him, who plots against him, or who plots and fights against his people, the church. Since that's the case, King David, by prophecy, admonishes us and the world that here are some things you need to do. First he said, you, especially you rulers of the earth and you judges, you need to be wise and you need to be instructed. Wow, that's a pretty bold statement, isn't it? Think to yourself of saying to the rulers of this world and to the judges, be wise, be instructed. Learn from the great ruler and learn from the great judge. In 1538, John Lambert quoted these very words of this psalm to King Henry VIII of England. As the king had John burned at the stake, here's what John Lambert said. Now, ye kings, understand, O ye which judge the earth, be wise and learned. Serve the Lord with fear, and rejoice in Him with trembling. And then, even as his hands were catching on fire, he said, none but Christ, none but Christ. Psalm 211 speaks of serving God and rejoicing. In other words, don't fight His restraints. Rejoice in them and use them to serve the Lord. Verse 12 is of interesting note, because when you go back to verse 7, it had spoken of the resurrection. Jesus was resurrected from the dead. He was killed because they took counsel against Him and killed Him. Now He says in verse 12, kiss the Son. Or it could even be translated, kiss His feet. And kiss here means do homage. In fact, the New American Standard Version says, do homage to the Son. Show Him allegiance, recognizing Him as the King. Let us worship the Son, recognizing Him for who and what He is, rather than fighting against Him. Do not put nails in His feet, people, He says. Kiss His feet. Don't put nails in them out of hatred. Kiss His feet. Out of love, humble love and worship before Him. Otherwise, Psalm 2 prophesies that He will become full of wrath and all those who oppose Him will perish. If, however, you put your trust in Him and you take refuge in Him, then David says at the end of verse 12, you are blessed. You will be a man or a woman of happiness rather than of sorrow. People fought against Christ and they killed Him. But it was in vain, because He was raised from the dead, and right now He is reigning as King, and He is even watching this worship service. Obviously, it was a vain thing to plot against Jesus Christ. They failed then, and any effort today will fail. The only thing, therefore, to do is to take refuge in Jesus. And the way to get into Him is to be baptized into Him. Now, if you're here tonight and you've not yet done that, would you please think about this? And when we sing this invitation song, if you see that you're ready to be baptized and you want to be, you can come forward, we'll greet you, and we'll assist you in whatever it is that you need to do. Come forward right now, please, as we stand and sing. Jesus.